Raven's End, Part 2, Autumn. Chapter 1. All in a day, summer ended at Yamnuska. Molly knew it first. She awoke on a cold, gray morning and said, as the first statement of the day, "That's it."
What's it?" Zack asked.
Like couples who have lived together for a long time, the two birds seemed to fall asleep and wake up simultaneously.
"That's it," Molly repeated. "Summer's over."
"You know, I think you're right," Zack agreed. "It's time."
Colin slept on, crouched in his corner of the roost, his head turning far back under his wing. He dreamed uneasily of black things moving in whiteness, of cold and silence.
"First, it's going to rain," Molly said.
"Then the rain will turn to snow," Zack continued.
"And that will be it," Molly concluded. Indeed, that was it. The rain started. Colin's dream began to include wet things as well as cold things. He woke up. He said, stretching out his wings.
"Gee, it's cold."
"Ought to be," said Zack. "It's summer's end today."
Molly turned to Colin and noted his puzzlement. "You don't remember, do you?" she said gently. "Well, it happens the same way every year. We get a day like this, soggy and chilly, and then the rain turns to snow way up here on Yamnuska. And that's really miserable, wouldn't you say, Zack?" He nodded. "But the snow melts away," she continued, "and then it warms up again, and it's, you know, autumn." The rain continued all morning, right through the flap. The birds spoke of nothing but the weather, and Maya's meteorological report confirmed what everyone was thinking. The temperature fell as the rain continued. By late afternoon, scattered flakes of wet snow were tumbling out of the clouds along with the rain. Then one of the sharper peaks poked a hole in the cloud deck. Down came the contents. By dark, the rocks were white. By the next morning, everything was coated thickly. All the warmth in the world had been lost, it seemed, and just as Molly had predicted, the birds were miserable.
"By the trees,"
Zack complained loudly, shaking off the accumulation from his wings.
"I can't get used to this. Happens every year, and every year it's unbearable."
He stalked around the roosting ledge, picking up first one black foot, then the other, flicking off slush. Colin's thoughts were on his crop. How could he and the others find food under the snow? "What do we do?" he asked, growing worried.
"About what?"
Zack replied in an irritated voice.
"About breakfast," Colin continued. "How are we going to find anything to eat?"
Zack saw the fear in Colin's eyes and reassured him.
"Not to worry. There's still plenty to eat. That elk carcass isn't gone yet, and that sheep up the valley, well, there's lots on the sheep."
"But what about the snow?" Colin persisted. "How can we find anything under the snow? Everything looks different today."
"Oh, I see," Molly said sympathetically. "You can't remember about snow. Well, my first snowfall, I was scared too. Terribly scared. All the landmarks I knew were gone. No, not gone. They had changed. The trees didn't look familiar. And even Raven's End looked so strange, as if I'd never seen it before. But it's okay, Colin. The snow will melt. And even when it comes back, and it will, you know, because winter's coming, well, even then you'll get to know all the places here just as well as you know them now. Every bird does." To prove her point, Molly coasted off directly toward the elk carcass for breakfast. She found it easily enough, but Colin lost his bearings and had to follow her. Most of the flock was already there, leaving their big three-toed tracks in the snow as they walked about the cougar's kill, now well picked over. Still, the birds found a bit of this and a bit of that. Something red clinging in a crevice between two ribs, or something unidentified adhering to the skull. The meat was powerfully ripe by now, and even a small piece was enough. Back at Raven's End with their crops full, the birds felt somewhat better. Still, the flap started out sorrowfully, with lots of complaining and petty squabbling.
"We didn't have snow this early last year."
"Oh, yes, we did. Don't you remember?"
"Well, that was the year before, dummy."
"Who's a dummy?"
The main raven said reassuring things about the long-term outlook for carrion availability this season, the quality and quantity of the various fall berries, and so on. But nothing improved the humor of the meeting, until the sun broke through the clouds. Suddenly the mood of the flock changed. The cold mass of insecurity in every bird's heart melted instantly as heat and warmth beamed down between the clouds. Colin blinked. What had been a scene of frigid desolation was now a landscape of brilliantly white beauty. Without another thought, the flock made the motion. The blackness of their outspread wings gathered the sun's power into their daily wheel of unity, and with a mighty rock-a-taw, they all leapt into the air at once, surging upward as fast as they could toward that hot spot in the sky, the spot that every bird knew to be the most important thing in their lives, as it was to all the animals and plants on Yamnuska, to all life in the Rockies, to every living thing in all the mountain ranges and on all the plains and oceans of the world. A few hours later, the sun had turned the snow to dripping water. A day later, the rocks were dry again. But the work of the weather had been done. The storm was a signal, and the plants got the message. The poplar-like aspens, especially, took notice. They had been waiting for this. In the spring, they had responded to a different signal, one that had said, "Grow." And dutifully, they had grown, sprouting new leaves, strong and bright, full of brand new chlorophyll. All through the summer, those leaves had worked hard, using sunlight to turn water and carbon dioxide into starch, cellulose, proteins, and wood fiber, growing thicker trunks, heavier branches, new twigs, new roots. But by late summer, the leaves were wearing out. They had gone from the shiny, vigorous green of spring to the dull, weary green of late summer. Their enzymes and hormones and catalysts were drying up. Instead of feeding the tree, the leaves were now feeding mainly the insect larvae that nibbled at their edges and chewed serpentine tracks through their centers. The leaves were glad to feel the snow. They were ready to retire. This they always did in style, by having the show. That's what the ravens called it, the show. They had a saying about it, "First the snow, then the show." "Oh, Zack," Molly called on the second morning after the end of summer storm, "there's a streak of yellow over there." Across the Bow Valley, a large grove of aspen had come into its fall color. Since every tree in the grove was joined at the roots to every other tree, they all got the word at once, "Do it, now." And they did. They let the chlorophyll in their leaves go from green to colorless, and the yellow carotene, present all the while in the leaves but masked by the green, emerged from hiding. Every aspen in the grove went gloriously gold. Yes, the show was on, and it grew better by the day. The evergreens contributed by darkening their needles to afford maximum contrast against the aspen patches,
which spattered the foothills with yellow. On the forest floor, too, the show erupted. This was wild rose country, and countless thousands of rose bushes went from summer green to autumn red. Every rose leaf, half the length of a raven's bill, blushed brighter by the hour. In flight, the birds could see the dots of red below, each advertising the rose hips, the fruits of the roses, to any creature that might desire them. These rose hips were glossy red and swollen with seeds, good for a bird. Good for the roses, too, which knew that the ravens would scatter the seeds far and wide as they excreted them in flight. As the bright blue days of fall continued, Colin and Zack and Molly feasted on rose hips, and raspberries, and gooseberries, and all the other gifts of that prickly tribe. They plucked the last of the choke cherries off the bushes that grew by the edges of the woods. They climbed with the updrafts to higher elevation, where the leaves of the low bush cranberry presented the reddest red of all. In dry places along the sunny banks of the Bow River, the birds found snowberries, pure white and tasting of winter. Black twinberries ripened in cool, shady spots where the morning frost stayed longer. The frost soaked into every kind of berry, bearberry, blueberry, dewberry, buffalo berry, crowberry, elderberry, bunchberry, grouseberry. And the frost broke down the cells and released the sugars. Night by night, all this food grew sweeter. Black bears ran from one bountiful shrub to the next, eating urgently. They ripped at the fruit-laden boughs with their claws and stuffed the berries into their mouths, leaves and all, chewing only a few times and swallowing hard, driven by a powerful hunger. Each bear had to grow very fat if it was to survive the winter-long sleep that was soon to come. Overhead, the great fall migration began. Millions of birds, ducks, geese, robins, sparrows, warblers, followed the eastern edge of the Rockies on their way south. The eagles cruised over the rough gray ridges of the front ranges, while the hawks preferred the rolling green and yellow swells of the foothills. Some migrants journeyed west instead of south, across the mountains to the Pacific coast, where they could winter by the sea. A few of these traveling birds would stop each night at the east end of Yamnuska, where they were welcomed by the ravens as interesting visitors with tales to tell of summers spent in the taiga of mountain ranges far to the north, or on the tundra of the high Arctic. "Shall we join them?" Colin asked. "Join who?" Molly countered. "The other birds, the birds flying south. It sounds like fun."
"Oh, Colin, you're hopeless," she giggled. "Ravens don't fly south."
"Why not?" Molly was laughing too hard to reply, so Zack answered the question, trying not to show his amusement.
"We don't need to, Colin. Ravens already live in the best places in the world, like here at Yamnuska. And really, you know, we can live anywhere at all. Those other birds have to leave, or they'd starve in the winter. No bugs to eat. But we'll be fine. We can eat practically anything, so we stay put."
"But think of what we're missing, those tropical forests. They sound really great."
"Yes, indeed," Zack replied patiently. "But first you have to get there. And then you have to get back in the spring. Now, think about it. Of all those migrating birds, do you know how many make it back here?"
"Fewer than half." Colin blinked.
"We stay, and with good reason," Zack stated firmly, letting Colin know that the subject was closed.
Frost glazed the yellow aspen leaves every night, but it vanished every morning. There was no new snow, no rain. Afternoons were warm and lazy.
The sun covered its daily circuit without passing behind any clouds. Soon to lose its heat to the pale cold of winter, the sun provided all the living things below with a farewell treat. The ravens thought of the sun as a hole in the sky that poured out heat and light. The sun saw the ravens as tiny moving specks in the atmosphere. Specks of black, the sun's favorite color, for nothing loves the sun's warmth as much as the color black. And so the ravens were the sun's favorite birds. This was no surprise to the ravens, who knew it all along. Autumn swept quickly along the length of the Canadian Rocky Mountains. In only a few days, the signal, written in gold, had traveled from one end to the other. From the red and green argillite peaks surrounding Waterton Lakes to the shaly brown ridges sloping down to the Liard River, far to the north. The message was simple. To everything there is a season. Turn, turn, turn. Chapter 2. Colin spent much of his time that fall on the wing. He loved to fly, and he flew for hour after hour. He would climb for thousands of wing beats until his big flight muscles ached. Then he would soar, gliding from the top of one invisible column of rising air to the next, hunting out the thermals over and over until he could find them instinctively. From on high, he would look down, memorizing the lay of the land. Then he would descend. He would dive so fast that he could barely open his eyes against the scream of the wind, his private gale made by his own plummeting body. He could feel his hollow bones strain against the air pressure change. As the ground rushed up, he learned to flare his wings carefully, a few feathers at a time, and thus to pull out of these plunges under control. "No more juniper bush crashes for me!" he shouted into his roaring slipstream. He practiced to perfection the half-roll, the barrel-roll, the somersault, the mid-air stall, and all the other stunts and tricks he had seen the Raven's Enders do. He invented new ones. At the evening flights, he was eager to show off his growing skill, chasing about the sky with Molly and Zack and the others, who were astonished by Colin's rapid advancement in flying. Zack had to admit that Colin now flew better than he did, which was saying a lot, for Zack was one of the stronger birds in the flock. The only bird Colin couldn't catch was the main raven. And day by day, chase by chase, Colin was gaining. How could he keep improving? It was the sort of progress that one saw in a fledgling, not in an adult bird. Molly asked Greta about this. Greta's reply was to ask another question. "If you had no idea where you came from, wouldn't you at least want to know where you were going?" "Yes, but what does that have to do with..." "And wouldn't you want to become strong enough to get there?" "Well, I suppose, but Greta, I don't really understand." "There's no need to understand. Just have fun thinking about it." And Greta flew off. A raven has extraordinary vision, which is a good thing because a raven's sense of smell is rather weak, and the bird has to locate food mainly by sight. Colin was soaring above Raven's End one morning when something in the image on his retina tripped a switch in his brain. The switch turned on a message. "Hey, what was that?" Colin dived like a black thunderbolt. The image grew larger. An object down there was pure white against the gray limestone, and it was moving. As Colin whistled by, the white thing took fright. It bounded under a boulder. "Oh, sorry to frighten you," Colin called as he landed on the boulder. "I was just checking. Not hungry at all. Really not." "Well,
"You could have been a little more polite," came a small voice from under the rock. Colin apologized again, promised that he wouldn't attack, and the white thing came out into the sun. "This animal looked to be made of snow," thought Colin, gazing incredulously at it. Much smaller than a raven, its body was long and thin. It was all white, except for the tail, which had a black tip. Its eyes and nose were black, too. What was it? Colin continued the conversation by offering his own name. "I'm Colin C.C.," he said in a friendly way. "What's yours?"
"Optimistic Molt," said the creature.
It wiggled its white whiskers.
"Beg pardon?"
"That's my name, like it or leave it. An ermine can't be too careful about her name. Those who know me well sometimes call me Oppie for short. But you can't."
I wouldn't think of it," said Colin, noting how irritated the ermine sounded. And irritating, too. The voice was high, and the tone was sarcastic, almost sneering. "Tell me," Colin continued, trying to ignore the unpleasantness, "where did you get such a weird, I mean such a fascinating name?"
"Oh, it's just a little something I thought up. You probably already know that weasels get really boring names at birth. Mine was Ermina Mustela. Isn't that awful? So I got rid of it. Everybody told me that my coat changed color earlier in the season than anyone else's here at Weasel's End, which stands to reason because I'm way ahead on everything. So I chose Optimistic Molt. Quite a pretty name, don't you think?"
Sure, Colin replied, thinking just the opposite. "A charming name, really. But did you say Weasel's End?"
"Of course. Weasel's End. Where we are right now."
"But isn't it called Raven's End?"
"Oh, no. Absolutely not. Nobody ever named anything for ravens."
She peered down her nose and curled her lip.
"How vulgar. No offense intended, but you can see what I mean, I'm sure."
Colin stifled a laugh.
Of course," he agreed, trying to sound earnest. "We ravens understand that quite well."
"You do?"
"Well, this particular raven does."
"It's about time one of them did."
Optimistic Molt began licking her front feet.
Would you mind explaining to me how your coat changes color?"
Optimistic Molt looked up sourly.
"I've met smarter ravens. Surely you must have heard that I am the reddest of all the weasels around here in summer, and the whitest in winter. Everybody says so."
"But it's not really winter yet," Colin reminded her.
"Well, so what? We've had snow on the ground already this fall, haven't we? I'm just getting the jump on everyone, especially that nasty long-tailed weasel down the ridge who thinks that she's some kind of gift to the world."
Colin thought for a moment. "You're whiter in the winter, so no one can see you against the snow, right?"
"Hey, the bird has some brains after all. Of course. Just remember that in the winter, you are to refer to me as an ermine, not a weasel. I'm a weasel in the summer only."
She turned her head coyly.
"Or, if you like," she added, "you can call me a stoat in the summer. Those of good breeding call me a stoat, and an ermine when I'm all white."
"Certainly," Colin agreed.
"But why is the tip of your tail black?"
"That is a very elementary question, and I will answer it for you only because you seem nicer than most ravens. There is a dreadful creature, I won't mention its name, that actually kills weasels."
"No,"
Colin said, sounding shocked.
Yes, despite the good we do, getting rid of all those mice every year, they'd reproduce themselves right out of business. The whole valley would be full of stupid little rodents, and then where would we be? I mean, really.
Optimistic Molt hesitated, giving Colin time to interject another question.
This creature that dares to attack weasels, he said, what does it look like?
Well, it's a bird, a big one, and it flies at night. But that's all I'm going to say about it, except that it's fairly stupid, and it falls for the old black tail trick every time.
What's the black tail trick?
Oh, it's a wonderful trick. No one else has it except us weasels. You see, the owl... Oh dear, I did use its name.
The weasel looked suddenly frightened. She flattened herself on the rock, at the same time bunching her body up in the middle as if she were about to jump away. And then she regained her composure and continued talking.
Yes, well, the shall we say, savage attacker comes down to grab the poor, defenseless ermine in its talons. But at the last moment, the ermine flicks that black tip, and the killer is distracted by it. It strikes at the tip. But the tip is just hair, no bones. So the stupid owl gets nothing. Oh dear, I've said it again.
Optimistic Molt cowered once more.
I'm going, she said. This place is just too exposed for my taste. That horrible prairie falcon could be around. Oh dear, I've said its name too. I really must be off. How nice to have met you. Let's not meet again. Goodbye.
Rather than running away, the little weasel seemed to melt into the landscape. Her long white body bent this way and that, worming through the spaces between boulders. She would disappear under a rock, then reappear on the other side. Her head would pop up, whiskers wiggling. Her tiny black eyes would peer here and there. Then she would vanish again. Colin watched, fascinated by the way the animal moved. So this was an ermine, the terror of the small mammal population, he supposed. That skinny, slinky body could easily slip down the burrows of the deer mice, or enter the grass-lined runs of the pikas. Hadn't that pika, what was its name? Ah, yes, Okatona. Hadn't Okatona talked about danger from weasels? Optimistic Molt stopped for a moment atop a small boulder. She squatted, then she moved on. Colin flew over to see. There, on the rock, was a fresh dropping. Fairly long and very dark, it lay between orange and yellow lichens, draped, Colin felt, in a way that indicated some forethought as to its placement. As Colin contemplated the dropping, Optimistic Molt called out from some distance away.
Nice arrangement, if I do say so myself.
Chapter 3. Later that morning, playing in the rapids of air gusting around the south face of Yanuska, Colin heard something falling down the cliff. Bonk, clonk,
ping!
Heads up! Came a human voice. I dropped a beaner.
One of those new ones? Came another voice.
Afraid so.
There were two humans halfway up the south face. Colin hadn't seen many climbers since the end of summer, but today seemed especially warm, so it was no wonder that humans were out and about in the mountains. Both of these were dressed in red sweaters. With their yellow helmets, they stood out brightly against the somber limestone. One climber was directly over the other, higher up. A blue rope ran between them. The climbers were in one of Yamnuska's big inside corners, where two slabs of rock came together at an angle, like two walls on a tall building. Colin swung in close to the cliff, alighted on a projecting pinnacle of rock, and settled down to watch and listen. John, one of the climbers called. No more rope.
Okay, came the reply.
John was going to have to find a stopping place because the rope between him and the other climber was used up. John looked around, located a small ledge in the corner, and stepped over to it. He did something with one of the shiny items hanging at his waist. Climbers carry lots of shiny things, Colin noted. And called down to the other climber.
On belay, Linda.
Colin looked toward this Linda creature. Brown braids swung from under her helmet.
Climbing,
she called to John. Then upward she went. Colin was surprised at how agile these humans were. From where he was sitting, the rock looked blank. Nothing to hang on to. But Linda was moving up nonetheless, and she was not using the rope for help. John took up the slack as she climbed toward him up the corner, one foot and one hand on each wall, a little way out from where the two walls met. Her fingers ran over the rock surface, coming to rest on small holds. She took short steps, carefully shifting her weight with each move. Linda quickly and gracefully closed the gap between herself and John. Soon they were together at John's stopping place. It was so small that only one of them could stand there at a time. So Linda didn't wait long. She took all the shiny things John was carrying and started upward again. John let the rope out little by little as she climbed higher. When Linda was a couple of body lengths above John, she stopped. She was practically level with Colin's perch and only a few steps away, but she was preoccupied and didn't see him. She looked into the crack at the back of the corner as if searching for something. Then she took a little silvery item from the climbing gear at her waist, stuck it into the crack, fiddled with the rope, and climbed higher. An instant later, Linda fell.
John! She yelled. Walk!
Colin cried. This would be the end of her. Humans couldn't fly. But hardly had she started falling than she stopped. Instead of smashing into the boulders at the base of the south face, she was suspended from the rope. Well, this was incredible, Colin thought. If the humans hadn't figured out how to avoid falling at all, well, they had at least figured out how to avoid falling very far. Linda seemed surprisingly unflustered. She rested for a moment in the corner, all her weight on the rope, and then she got back onto the rock.
You okay?
John called up.
Yeah,
Linda replied, almost casually. Hold broke.
That must have been what hit me in the helmet,
John said. The little chip of rock had put a new scratch there among many old ones in the yellow plastic.
Didn't hurt, though. Okay, I'm trying again.
Gotcha. Linda climbed back up to the place where she had fallen. She hesitated there, put another item in the crack, and continued climbing. Every couple of body lengths, she put something else in the crack, until John called up, just as Linda had, that the rope was fully extended. Linda found a ledge and sat down on it. Using yet another bit of gear, she hooked the loop of the rope to something sticking out of the cliff. Now John climbed up to Linda. She took up the rope as he climbed, and he collected all the little shiny things that Linda had put in the crack. Nothing was left behind.
So this was how it all worked, Colin thought. Humans may be crazy to climb on these cliffs, but they were awfully smart in their craziness. Yet, why did they climb on Yamnuska in the first place?
Linda's ledge was big enough for both climbers to sit on. Tied securely to the rock, they casually dangled their legs over the edge. A warm breeze was flowing up the face. It was now midday, and all morning the rock had basked in the sun. Yamnuska was warm to the touch, in turn warming the air that touched it. The heated air rose in a thin sheet caressing the rough limestone. This was the friendly breeze felt by the climbers. They took off their sweaters. John carried a small pack, and now he opened it. Out came lunch. Colin was immediately interested, and he flew closer to the two. Perched nearby, he saw and smelled his favorite human food, a peanut butter and jam sandwich. He croaked hungrily, and the climbers heard him.
"Gee, that bird's sitting awfully close," John said.
"What kind is it, a crow?"
"Nah, it's a raven. Look how big it is."
"Here, Mr. Raven." Linda threw Colin a piece of her sandwich. Colin gobbled it down.
"Wow," said John. "He sure ate that fast. Well, let's try some trail mix on him."
Linda pulled a plastic bag out of her pack and reached into it, withdrawing a handful of tasty-looking peanuts, raisins, and chocolate chips. Some of it spilled down the rock, and Colin immediately flew down to intercept what he could of it. He caught a raisin in midair.
"He got it! Neat!"
Colin came even closer. He hopped onto the same ledge the climbers were sitting on.
"Hey, I've never seen that before," John said. "Ravens don't usually get this close to people."
"Maybe it's really a crow," Linda said, defending her earlier opinion.
"Well, a crow wouldn't get this close either."
John reached out his hand. In the center was another hunk of sandwich. Colin started to hop over and take it, and then he suddenly remembered what Zack and Molly had said about humans. He backed off.
"See, he's not dumb," John said. "He won't eat out of my hand."
"I'll just leave him some over here." Linda set down a corner of her sandwich on the ledge. Colin crept over warily, seized it, and flapped over to his perch to eat. Linda pulled a plastic bottle full of water out of John's pack. She took a long drink from it and passed it to him. He was thirsty too, and drank the rest. John closed up the little pack, and they prepared to climb on. Linda took the lead again.
"Bye-bye, Mr. Raven," she said, looking over at him with a smile. "See you on top, maybe."
Colin watched the climbers all afternoon. They reached the summit of Yamnuska just as the sun went down. They didn't stay there for long. In a hurry to descend the mountain before dark, they coiled their rope and jogged off down the hiker's trail on the north side of the peak. The summit of Yamnuska was marked by a cairn, a stack of rocks, and Colin sat on it after the climbers had left. He wondered again why they did what they did. If they just wanted to reach the top, they could have walked up the trail. If they had been looking for something to eat, they wouldn't have carried their lunch with them. Maybe that was it. Maybe humans had to carry their food to places like the South Face, well away from everything, in order to eat it. Their food was so good. Perhaps other animals or maybe other humans would steal it if they could. So humans had to come up here to eat. Oh, that must be it. Colin croaked a self-satisfied croak. He decided that he liked these climber humans. He croaked again, thinking of the wonderful food they had given him, and to his surprise he was answered. Looking southward, he saw the whole flock of Raven's Enders dancing out into the great empty space of the south face. The mystery of why humans climbed cliffs had to be put aside. Now it was time for the flight. Molly had called to Colin as she passed over the summit. That bird, she had thought. There he was, sitting all by himself. He'd been gone the whole afternoon. Doing what? Perching on the summit cairn? She'd never understand what went through his mind. But he was always thinking, she was sure of that. The flock soared and wheeled in the sunset. Ravens were arriving from every direction, greeting one another and announcing where they had been that day. Brendan had made quite a trip, flying south right across the Bow Valley in search of rose hips.
"Oh, hey, you should see the hips over there," he called.
Most of the birds moved closer to Brendan.
"They were like mega,"
he continued, doing a barrel roll for emphasis.
"Awesome! Really excellent! I'm going back tomorrow for more. Who's going with me? Sarah?"
Sarah, like Brendan, had fledged that spring. The two had taken some flying lessons together from the Maine Raven, and they liked each other. Sarah replied to Brendan's invitation.
"Sure, I'll go. Hey, Mum, can I go?"
"If you don't mind me coming, too."
Marg had a sweet spot in her crop for rose hips, especially if they were as good as Brendan said they were. Besides, she thought she'd better come along anyway to look after the youngsters in case they ran into trouble.
Chapter 4. It began as an ordinary autumn day in the Canadian Rockies. At the morning flap, Dulles and Garth were back in the circle. They had been away longer than expected. A few days in exile were normally enough punishment for fighting. And both seemed changed. They spoke in friendly voices, and Dulles said he was very sorry for stealing from Molly. Zack apologized to Dulles for taking the first peck during the fight. Dulles apologized to Zack. With genuine affection, the banished birds were welcomed back. Colin felt that there could be no better bunch of CCs in the whole world. He had given up hope of remembering where he had come from originally, and even though this bothered him from time to time, it was bearable now that the Raven's Enders had taken him in. Zack and Molly were good friends, and he was getting to know the other birds better as the days passed. When the flock made the motion, spreading their wings toward each other and creating that wonderful wheel shape of solidarity, Colin knew he could now join in. What a privilege to be considered a Raven's Ender, even if it was only temporary. Rocket haw! As usual, Colin flew off on his own after the flap. He made his way up the valley behind Yamniska. Many things about this place were starting to make sense, yet the more he learned, the more he wanted to know. Humans, for example. What were humans all about? Colin had talked at length about humans one day with Zack and Molly, and he hadn't learned much, except that Molly considered them terribly dangerous, and Zack considered them terribly stupid. "They do the dumbest things," Zack had said. "Throwing away food, beating down the ground where they walk, so nothing grows on it, letting these idiot dogs go everywhere with them. I tell you, Colin, I've even seen them sticking fire into their mouths. Would you believe it? They must burn themselves inside. Smoke comes out." Colin was trying to imagine this when something caught his attention. There, on the trail to Yamniska's summit, were a couple of hikers. Fancy that, he thought. Start thinking about humans, and they show up. He changed course. Having been warned repeatedly about approaching humans too closely, Colin glided by at a safe distance. He hadn't told any of the other birds about the afternoon he had spent with the climbers. Molly, particularly, would have been shocked to learn that he had been right on the same ledge with them. These humans might be climbers, too, Colin thought as he looked them over. They had on bright red jackets, like some of the climbers wore, and red hats, too. They carried packs, and they also had sticks with them. Hikers on Yamniska often carried walking sticks, but climbers didn't, he recalled. They carried ropes instead. Colin couldn't see any ropes, so he decided that these were hiker humans, not climber humans. Both kinds of humans always carried goodies in their packs, and often they had trail mix.
The thought of that exquisite mixture of raisins and nuts and chocolate chips lured Colin on. He sailed close by the hikers. As he did, he saw that one of them was carrying something that made smoke, just as Zack had said. Colin flapped ahead of the hikers and landed on a boulder beside the trail. He wanted a close look at this fire-eating. When the humans were near, he saw that the fire was in a twig that one of them held between its fingers. Smoke came out the end of the twig, which was white, as if the bark had come off and the twig had lain in the sun a long time. Or maybe it was a little piece of bone, Colin thought. It was certainly white enough to be bone. The hikers were now very close, but Colin was so fascinated that he didn't fly away. They stopped. One of them spoke.
"Well, I'll be gall darned, Phil. This here crow is just sitting there. I could reach out and grab it. You ever seen the like?"
The one with the fire bone, which is what Colin decided it must be, stuck the thing into its mouth and sucked on it.
"I never seen a crow like this, neither. Pretty bold crow."
Smoke came out of the hiker as it spoke. Colin jumped back in horror. The human really was on fire.
"Whoa," it said, smoke puffing through its lips. "Don't fly off now, birdie."
The human stuck the fire bone back in its mouth. More smoke came out as it continued talking.
"By golly, that wind is cold."
The smoke blew away quickly, for the day was indeed getting windy. The wind came from the north, across the valley behind Yamnuska, and up the slope the humans were hiking across.
"Them clouds are looking pretty ornery. Want to stop here a while, Frank? Kind of watch the weather?"
Colin and the humans eyed each other. And then, Colin noted happily, the hikers took their packs off. This was a good sign that eating would come next. Sure enough, out of the pack came a brown paper bag, and out of the bag came sandwiches. Colin could see the peanut butter and jam oozing out. Oh, joy! He hopped right over. Sitting there, the humans didn't know how to react. Colin was a large bird with a wingspan almost as broad as a human's outstretched arms. His body was as long as a human's forearm and hand. His bill was almost as long as a finger. And here he was, at arm's length, looking intently at the sandwich one of them was eating. Colin didn't wait to be offered a bite. He reached forward with his bill and grabbed. The human holding the sandwich fell backward in fright. The fire bone in its mouth fell out.
"Cripes! It's attacking!"
Hang on, Phil, the other one shouted. I'll get it.
The humans were yelling and jumping around. Colin decided he'd better leave. He leapt up, flapping hard, trying to carry the whole sandwich in his bill. But it was too heavy, and he couldn't get airborne.
"Oh, man, look at those wings!"
"Get clear, Phil, get clear!"
One of the humans had picked up the stick it had been carrying.
Uh-oh, thought Colin.
He dropped the sandwich and leapt again.
Bang!
Colin heard the loudest sound he had ever heard, and at the same moment he felt something tear through his right wing.
"Hark! Hey, you got him!"
Colin fell to the ground. He fluttered about, his wing completely numb. He ordered it to flap.
"By the trees, flap!"
he cried aloud. The wing quivered, but it would not obey him.
"Rip off my sandwich, eh? Shoot it again, Frank. You only winged him." Bang!
The rock next to Colin's bill shattered. Everything was ringing. Pain roared into his wing as the numbness left. There were bits of stone in his eyes. His brain was shrieking a single thought. "Fly! Fly!"
"But I can't fly," Colin told his brain. "Can't fly!"
"Then run," screamed his brain. "If you can't fly, run! Run away up the rocks!
Go, go!
One of the humans was waving its stick around. Missed! Stupid bird won't hold still. Colin's legs were doing what his injured wing could not. Desperately, they carried him up the rocky slope of Amnuska. He scrambled over boulders, hopping, falling, scratching his shins, breaking his feathers, running, running. The wind was helping, blowing him uphill. It carried something with it. Snow. Bang! The sound was farther away now. But again the rock exploded, underneath him this time, stinging his belly. A smell came with the pain. It was the sulphurous odor of fragmenting limestone, the same smell a falling rock makes as it tumbles down a cliff, battering itself to bits. To bits. Bits of snow. The wind so strong now. Bang! Something stung Cullen in the tail. Lock! Run! Run! And there, ahead of him, was the ridge line. Rock against sky. A million flakes of snow blowing him toward it. Only a little farther now.
Ah, he's gonna get away. But he'll die anyhow. You got him twice for sure, Frank.
Wished I'd had me a shotgun. That'd do it.
Since when do you go carrying a shotgun way up on Yamnuska? Ever shoot a bighorn with a shotgun?
No. But now I'm going to pack one anyway. Cause of the birds. Ha ha! Birds are bad up here, eh, Phil? Ha ha! Take a guy's sandwich right out of his hand.
Hee hee! Better go armed, eh? Hee hee!
A heavy gust of wind whirled snow in the faces of the humans.
It's blowing a blizzard. Let's get the heck off this boulder pile.
For sure, for sure. I can't hardly even see the trail.
The same gust caught Colin on the ridge. It picked him up, all agony and confusion, and flung him over the south face. Chapter 5. Brendan was out in front as he, Sarah, and Marg flew southward across the Vaux Valley. This was his idea, his trip, and he wanted to make sure that he, not Marg, led the way. He was ready for this, he thought, since he was all grown up. And he was, nearly. Coming into the world in April of that year, Brendan had been strong and smart from the start. He was the first in his brood to hatch, the first to fledge. He had arrived at Yamnuska from farther north along the mountain front, where his parents were members of the Black Rock Mountain flock. His grandmother had come from Raven's End, and when Brendan was still in the nest, she had told him wonderful stories about Yamnuska, about riding the thermals along the south face, about sunrise at Raven's End, about the flowery meadows and the willow marsh and the beaver ponds. As soon as Brendan was able to fly the distance, some would have said a little before he was able to fly the distance, he had set off alone to visit the Raven's End flock. He had barely made it, but he had also found that what his grandmother had told him was true, and he had stayed on at Yamnuska, which seemed an even more agreeable place after he met Sarah, Marg's only fledgling that year. Marg had lost her nestmate in the spring, just after the brood hatched. That made it very unlikely that any of the young birds would survive, for it took both parents to feed them. Marg tried to carry on, but she realized it was hopeless. All of the nestlings were starving. Still, she noticed that one of them, Sarah, was stronger than the others. She made a difficult decision. She chose Sarah over the rest. She kept Sarah fed as the others died, and thus Sarah had lived. When Sarah left the nest, Marg had the bittersweet satisfaction of producing at least one fledgling in a year that should have given her none. She considered this, watching Sarah and Brendan flying happily with her that morning. Yes, it had been the right thing to do. Marg thought about Brendan. Of the many young birds she had known, Brendan had outstanding qualities but he was also impulsive, ready to try any sparrow-brained idea. Yet he was so well-intentioned and quick to take direction from the older birds. Well, Brendan had promise. Marg remembered being like that herself, young, keen to show off, wanting everyone to listen to her, not to the main raven or Greta or the other old fuddy-duddies in the flock. Well, she'd be there to help if Brendan's exuberance got him and Sarah into trouble. Marg considered her daughter. Sarah now was different. Quiet. More careful. Studious. It was Sarah who had caught the first grasshopper of the year and brought it to the flap, wondering what it was. Everyone had laughed, and poor Sarah was embarrassed to a croak. Even that idiotic main raven had laughed. But Marg had comforted Sarah and demanded that the flock apologize. Here Sarah had come to them seeking help, and what had she received? Ridicule. It just wasn't fair. By this time, the birds were about halfway across the valley, right over the Bow River, where it passed through a particularly wide, level stretch called Morley Flats. Morley Flats was a place where the glaciers had dumped enormous quantities of stones. Trees shunned the place. The rocky ground would grow nothing but grass. Marg noticed that the grass was waving in the wind, and that her ground speed was picking up. All birds are sensitive to this. If the ground goes by more rapidly than it ought to, then there must be a tailwind. And quite a tailwind it was. Since the ravens were flying south, and getting kicked along smartly as they did so, the wind must have been coming from the north. Something about that north wind worried Marg. She couldn't quite get a wing around that worry, but there it was, something. Sarah and Brendan, too, had noticed the tailwind. Now they played in it, climbing and diving as they tried to find the faster currents. "This is great!" Brendan croaked, catching a particularly powerful gust. He coasted right by Sarah and Marg. "Hey, wait for me!" Sarah called, flapping furiously. She, too, caught Brendan's gust, and the two left Marg behind for a moment. Then both the young birds were amazed to see Marg breeze by. She seemed to have found an even faster stream in the rushing atmosphere. But Marg wasn't enjoying the wind. She was troubled by it. They were now a long way from Raven's End, and they would have to come back home against that wind. Well, maybe it would die down in the afternoon. Think positively, she told herself. There was no turning those kids around. Brendan wouldn't hear of it, and they were too old to order about. She just hoped that everything would be all right. "That's the spot!" Brendan pointed his bill down to the left. By this time, they were over the foothills flanking the south side of the Bow Valley. The slopes below were a patchwork of meadows divided by groves of aspen and stands of spruce. The birds pulled in their wings and dived toward one of the meadows. They had to lose elevation quickly or be blown past their objective. As it was, they missed it and had to haul themselves back northward against the wind. Just before landing, Marg cautioned her eager companions. "Now remember, you should always perch a while before landing on the ground in unfamiliar territory," she instructed. "You never know. There might be a coyote in the willows over there, or maybe a marten behind that rock."
"Ah, we know, Mum," Sarah complained. "You don't have to tell us everything." "Sorry, kids. I just can't help it, I guess. But we must be extra careful this far from home."
They were sitting in a small aspen. Its golden leaves were gone. Most of them had blown away that very day. And the wind was strong enough to rock the tree. The meadow grass below was brown, and everything had the look of late fall. After waiting and watching for what seemed like much too long to Brendan, Marg fluttered down to the ground. She performed the ritual of the lead, doing jumping jacks over to the patch of wild roses. Just as Brendan had said, the rose hips here were magnificent. Red and plump, they were huge, too big to swallow whole, and taut with goodness. Brendan pulled one off its stem. He burst the hip in his bill, then tilted his head back and let the mealy, seedy insides tumble down his throat. "Wargle, look, scrooge," he said through the enormous billful.
"Say what?" Sarah queried. "I said," Brendan repeated, "there's some Saskatoons over there."
Not waiting for a response, he hopped across the meadow, nearly getting blown over in the wind. A patch of purple Saskatoon berries waved like heavy wheat. Somehow this prize had not been found by any other creature since it had set fruit many weeks ago. And now, sweetened wonderfully by the frost, it was all theirs. They fell to it greedily, downing berry after berry.
"You kids look like waxwings in a feeding frenzy," Marg scolded. "Let's watch our manners."
But it was hard for Marg to control herself, let alone the young ravens. They might as well enjoy this late autumn treat, she reasoned, and try to remember the place when winter came. At this thought, an icy chill ran up her spine. Suddenly she realized what had been bothering her so much about this wind. She jerked about and faced into it. What she saw terrified her. A wall of cloud, full of snow, cold and white as death, was already halfway across Morley Flats, coming in low and fast.
"Oh, no!" she cried. "It's a cold blow! Kids, stop what you're doing! We've got to get out of here!"
Chapter 6. The evening flight was cancelled that day, for the weather had turned suddenly and utterly bad. Zack and Molly huddled on their roosting ledge, buffeted by wind and snow, wondering where Colin was.
"He could be anywhere," Zack offered. "That bird flies so far."
"It really is a cold blow, isn't it?" Molly replied, wincing as a gust threw snow into her eyes. "And Maya never manages to predict it."
"You'd think she would. We get a couple of these every year."
"Oh, Zack!" Molly cried. "I forgot! Marg and Sarah and Brendan flew right over the Bow River today. They might be way across Morley Flats."
Zack blinked. "They could be in serious trouble. There's no place to hide over there." He gripped the rock tightly with his feet and tucked his head under his wing as another snowy blast tried to tear him from the ledge. Molly shook off an instantly applied coating of white.
"The poor things! It's just lucky they had Marg along. She won't panic. She's steady. She would have turned them around the minute she saw the cold blow coming."
Still, Molly kept worrying.
"I just wish they were back, including Colin. It's getting dark."
"Oh, he can take care of himself," Zack said. "You know, Molly, I don't think Colin needs us like he used to."
"I just hope he wasn't involved in that shooting up near the summit this afternoon."
"Did you hear that, too? I was off in the North Valley. Didn't see anything. By the time I got over there, the blow was coming in and the humans were leaving."
"Well, I didn't see anything either, but you know how humans are. They were certainly trying to kill something."
"Hey, with any luck, they shot a sheep. Maybe they didn't take it away. We'll get it."
"Oh, Zack, I hope you're right. That would be a great way to start the winter."
Molly was hungry. She hadn't eaten much that day because she didn't like flying in heavy wind, and it might be another day before the birds could go out scavenging.
All the same, I'm worried about Colin. Maybe he can't remember what a cold blow is like. Maybe he'll try to fly home instead of weathering it where it catches him.
Well, we'll just have to see. But I wouldn't be surprised if he arrives in the middle of the storm, and in the middle of the night. He's strong enough to do it.
Chapter 7 Colin wasn't arriving anywhere. Wounded and desperate, he was in the grip of the north wind, which had tumbled him over the crest of Yamnuska. The wind was very angry, as the leading edge of a cold front always is. This particular weather system had raged out of the Arctic and down the Rockies, battering the peaks, snapping off trees, killing the small songbirds caught in it. It tried to kill Colin. It saw that some of his feathers had been broken by the gunshots, and it broke a few more. It felt around Colin's tail, found a sore spot, and flung sharp crystals of ice at it. Colin realized that he must be falling. He could see nothing through the roaring grayness of the storm, but he could feel the air chambers in his bones creaking. Soon he would feel something else, the pain of the crash. Twice he had plunged out of control from Yamnuska's heights. Zack had saved him the first time, and then the main raven had saved him. But this time, he knew. No one could save him but himself. As Zack had assured Molly, Colin was indeed a very strong raven, so strong that even a bullet through the wing hadn't stopped him. And now he showed another kind of strength, the strength of his will. What he did next hurt a great deal. He croaked out loud, it hurt so much. But he did it anyway. He straightened out his damaged wing and held it firm in the snow-filled fury of the storm. The bone, it seemed, had not been broken. With both wings at work, Colin regained control. Now he could ride with the wind instead of plummeting through it. Now he could survive.
Chapter 8 Sarah had been eating saskatoon berries, relishing the sweet goo inside each one, when she heard her mother's cry. She turned in Marg's direction and saw a white wall of wind and snow coming at them.
"Mom!" she cried. "What are we going to do?"
Brendan, too, had now seen the cold blow approaching. He tried not to show his fear, but his voice quavered.
"So can we just fly home now?"
Marg collected her thoughts. "We'll never make it home against that. We've got to get to a safe place, and quick. Brendan, Sarah, listen to me. When this storm hits, we'll hardly be able to see each other. So stay close to me. Really close, okay? We'll go with the wind. We'll try to keep ahead of the worst and hope we can find some shelter. Got that?"
"Yes, Mum,"
Sarah said, her bill opening wide and closing with a frightened click.
"Brendan, are you listening?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"So here we go. Stay close."
The three took off into the wind. It blew them backward. Marg and Brendan recovered enough to stay in the air and turn south, but Sarah tumbled over a buffalo berry bush and struck the ground. She jumped again. This time she cleared the shrubbery, but just as she began to gain elevation, her left wingtip brushed against an aspen branch. She spun around. Her head struck the trunk of the tree. She went limp and fell to the ground. A heavy gust swept through the clearing. It rolled Sarah over and over across the meadow until she caught against an outcropping of rock. There she lay in the dead brown grass. Like the grass, she too was soon covered with snow.
Chapter 9 Colin and the wind came to an understanding.
"I'm very angry," said the wind.
and I won't tolerate anyone flying with me. Get out.
No way, Cullen retorted. I'm alive, in spite of everything, and you can't hurt me any more than I've been hurt already.
In that case, you have my admiration, said the wind. You are a strong-willed bird indeed. But that doesn't mean I have to like you.
Then don't.
It's a deal, shrieked the wind.
All right, Cullen shouted back. And on he went, carried southward into the night, on the back of a storm. This is amazing, he said to himself. I've been talking with a tempest. Chapter 10 Marg and Brendan didn't look back. Once above treetop level, the wind was so fierce that it demanded all their attention. They couldn't have seen that Sarah was no longer with them. They shot southward with the storm front, sometimes kicked up or down or sideways or even backward. The forest passed below in a green blur, now going gray as the sky around them filled with snow. Adding to the grayness was darkness. The wind seemed to be blowing away the remaining daylight. Marg knew that they had to find refuge, and soon. Ravens were not night flyers. Trying to navigate in the dark, never mind the storm, was out of the question. She hoped that the wind would carry them to a leeward slope where they, like the snow and the wind, would find a place to settle. She wondered where that place might be. Despite the storm, Brendan stayed close to Marg. He knew that his life depended on it, and when he saw her fighting to descend, he fought his way down, too, down through the crazy currents of the cold front. Just as the last light of day was lost, Marg saw what she had been looking for. A cliff facing southward. A cliff on the far side of the foothills rimming the Bow Valley. A downwind haven for three ravens in trouble. She turned to look for Brendan and Sarah. Barely visible in the whirling snow, there were two other ravens following her. But one of them didn't look right. Something was wrong with either Brendan or Sarah. The bird was holding its wings in a strange way, as if it were injured. Well, she would soon find out. It was only a little way now. Already the wind was more manageable here in the lee of the cliff. She would just guide the other two toward what looked like a sheltering break in the rock. If it was what she thought it was, they were going to survive. At that moment, the bird with the injured wing caught up with her. It was bigger than Sarah, or Brendan, or even herself. It was Cullen! But where, oh where, was Sarah? Chapter 11 Sarah lay beside the rock outcrop, snow sticking in her feathers and piling up around her. Groggy from hitting the tree, too weak to try another takeoff, she felt the snowflakes covering her legs, her wings, her head. She closed her eyes. Perhaps Marg and Brendan, at least, had found a safe place. Perhaps they would live to tell the rest of the flock what had happened to her. Dying wasn't hurting as much as she had imagined it would. Her thoughts grew hazy, and she passed out. Snow piled up at the foot of the rock, covering Sarah entirely. It was a cold blanket, to be sure, but it kept the icy wind from reaching through. Would she freeze to death under that white coverlet? No doubt. But it would take a long time. She slept, dreaming of her sun-warmed roosting ledge on Yamnuska, with Marg and Brendan pressed closely beside her. Chapter 12 The break that Marg had seen in the cliff turned out to be a deep crack. Just what she had hoped for. She, Brendan, and Cullen landed on a great block of rock jammed into it. The three ravens stepped cautiously back into the gloom, ready to turn and fly if something had rushed toward them. But they found the shelter unused, at least not in use that evening. And then, out of the wind, safe and dry, they let their exhausted bodies sink down over their feet. Speechless, they fluffed out their feathers to keep themselves warm against the deepening cold. They tucked their heads far back under their wings and fell asleep. Marg dozed fitfully. Fear kept seizing her dreams, turning them to nightmares. Once she awoke fully. She looked out from the crack, where a strip of midnight blue sky hung between the blackness of the rock walls. The strip was covered with stars. The wind had dropped from a howl to a whisper. All was well, she thought. The storm had passed. But then, like claws closing over her body, came the certainty that somewhere out there, lost and probably dead, was Sarah. Marg let out a soft cry of anguish. Grawr! At this moment, Colin also awoke. Marg's cry had ended a vivid dream. He recalled every detail. In the dream, a sleeping raven lay on the ground. Snow fell, covering the bird. He, Colin, could see this as if he were soaring above. Then the scene began to move. It moved away from him. No, he was rising above it, and he could see a rock outcropping at the edge of a meadow. Then the meadow grew smaller, and he could see that it was on a hillside. Higher still, Colin's dream took him, until he could see that the hillside was part of a low ridge forming the southern boundary of Morley Flats. Yet higher he went, and he could see the other side of the ridge, where the very cliff in which they were sheltering came into view. Marg, he said quietly, don't worry. I know where she is. Marg was shivering, not with cold, but with grief. Sarah, oh, my dear lost Sarah. Marg, Colin repeated. Marg, I know where Sarah is, and she's alive. Tomorrow, if I can fly at all, we'll go there. Chapter 13. I'm hungry. It was Brendan speaking. Brendan had said, I'm hungry, as his first message to the new day ever since he had hatched. He still said it out of habit, without thinking. He shook his head and looked around. Where was he? Panic sent him jumping to his feet as he looked at the unfamiliar surroundings. Then he remembered. Yesterday had started off so beautifully. He and Sarah flying together across the valley. He finding the rose hips in exactly the right place. He and Sarah eating them together. But then it had ended so horribly. Here he was, perched on a cold block of rock in a crack in some cliff, far away from Yamnuska. Well, at least they were all here, safe and sound. Marg had found this place. How had she done that? It was, like, amazing to be able to do that. Hey, that had been a close call, but they'd made it. Yesterday was a lesson learned. Now they would fly home to Raven's End and tell the flock about it, he and Sarah and Marg. All right, maybe they'd let him tell it. He stretched forward, noting how much longer his neck feathers were growing. Soon they would be just as long as those of the other adult birds. He began to unfurl his wings, and in so doing he jostled Colin, who was roosting close by. Hawk! Colin cried, waking to the pain of something brushing against his injured wing. Brendan jumped back. You're
not Sarah.
No, I'm not Sarah. Ooh, I'm sore. He shook himself, gathering his wits. Sarah's not here. We have to find her before the coyotes do. Marg!
Brendan was stunned. Sarah not here? But where? And Colin, where had Colin come from?
Marg woke up slowly. First one eye opened, then the other. They seemed less bright than usual, Colin thought. But as Marg became fully awake, she didn't have to be told what the first order of the day would be. She rose to her feet without a thought of her empty stomach.
Colin, last night you...
Yes, last night I told you I knew where Sarah was, and I still do. She's on the other side of the ridge, at the edge of a clearing beside a ledge. Is that where you left her yesterday?
Well, we didn't leave her there, Colin, but yes, that's where I saw her last.
Marg recounted the story. We'd been eating berries when the storm came in. I thought we all got away, but I guess Sarah didn't. It's my fault. I didn't notice anything wrong until it was too late. Oh, I feel so awful about this whole thing.
Marg's wings were fluttering. It's all my fault. It really is. I...
No, Marg, it's not your fault, Colin comforted. You did your best, and you found this place, too. Marg's expression changed to one of confusion.
But, Colin, how did you know about Sarah? How did you come to be here with us?
Oh, I got caught in the storm, too, he said, after a human hurt me with some sort of stick thing in my wing. Carefully, he stretched out the damaged wing.
Fuck! Oh, that hurts!
He pulled the wing back.
You poor thing, Marg said, moving closer to him. But let me see.
Colin extended his wing again. It hurt less to do it this time, but he couldn't stretch it far. Marg looked at the wing carefully. She could see blood on it, a big, dark clot of blood that stuck the feathers together.
Oh, Colin, how could you fly at all? I'll bet those humans shot you with a gun. You're lucky you weren't killed.
She looked at his tail. Two feathers were missing there.
Does that hurt? She asked, touching him lightly with her bill. Fuck!
No, not much, Colin replied.
Oh, rat poop, Marg, I'm sore all over.
They shot you in the tail, too. We'll have to get Greta to look at you when we get home. Brendan was becoming more and more agitated, hopping about.
But Sarah, what about Sarah?
Colin flapped his wings and twisted his tail, trying to work out the stiffness. He had to fly, that's all there was to it. He hopped over to the front of the crack, took a deep breath, and jumped off the cliff.
Oh, it hurt. It hurt to the core. But yes, he could fly, missing feathers and all. The injured right wing wasn't very strong, but at least it went up and down a little. The other wing would simply have to work that much harder.
Colin, said Marg. Dear Colin, you are a brave, strong bird. She had followed him out of the crack and was now flying beside him. And here came Brendan.
Let's go find Sarah, Brendan said. Then let's eat.
Chapter 14. Back at Raven's End, the flock assembled for the flap. It was a subdued group of ravens. The storm had been most unpleasant. There wasn't a single roost on Yamnuska that was really protected from it. And although the wind had died, the temperature had dropped considerably. The sun was only a spot of brighter gray in the overcast sky. Slate-colored clouds of ice crystals drifted among the snow-covered peaks. The scene had no warmth and no color. Winter had arrived. and brutally. But the birds had more than that on their minds. What had happened to Marg, Sarah, and Brendan? And where was Colin? Rumors passed from bill to bill, but nobody really knew anything definite. The main raven convened the flap. He tried to sound cheerful.
"Cc's, and a very good morning it is, wouldn't you say?"
As he peered around the circle, looking at each bird briefly, the main raven saw nothing but worry in their eyes. Few said back to him.
"Maya seems not to be with us this morning, so we shall have to dispense with the news."
Indeed, Maya had not turned up. Most of the Townsend solitaires in the valley migrated south each winter, but a few, including Maya, stayed behind. Maya loved Raven's End too much to leave it, even during the winter months. This was her first absence ever at the flap, and the other birds knew what that implied. Their spirits fell even further.
"Well," the main raven continued, "how did we all weather the storm? I'd like to hear each bird's own story of this exciting event."
Zack wasn't going to wait for his turn. He spoke up immediately.
"I'm very worried about Marg, Brendan, and Sarah," he stated. "They went over to Morley Flats and haven't come back. Would anyone like to go with Molly and me to look for them?"
"I'll go with yous," said Scratch.
"Me too," said Wheedle.
"Okay," said Zack.
But he was thinking that this wasn't a particularly strong search party.
"Anyone else?"
he asked.
"You can count me in," said Dolus.
"If Dolus is going, then I'm going too," said Garth.
Uh-oh, Zack thought. He was wary of these two birds. They hadn't been seen much since returning to the flock, and they hadn't said anything at the flaps about what they'd been doing. Why the sudden interest in a rescue trip? But if they wanted to help, he could use them.
"If Dolus and Garth are going, I'm not going, and neither are you, Zack."
It was Molly. She was even more suspicious of Dolus's motives than Zack was.
"Dolus," she said pointedly, "exactly why are you so interested in this?"
"Oh, I'm just trying to help out,"
he replied, his eyes flicking around the circle.
"Just trying to help out, that's all."
At this point, the main raven interrupted.
"Well, that's a most heartening attitude, Dolus. I'm pleased to hear it. Now, if you six want to be off, the rest of us wish you well."
"Just a moment," Molly interjected. "I'm not finished yet."
Her eyes were small and hard as she looked at Dolus intently.
"What were you doing over on Wakanda Buttress 2 days ago, Dolus?"
You mean with Zygadina?"
At the mention of Zygadina, several ravens twitched, involuntarily hunching their shoulders and opening their bills.
"Yes, with Zygadina. And what were you doing with Zygadina?"
"Oh, just talking. We were only talking."
"What were you eating, Dolus? What was it?"
"Oh, that. Well, Zygadina had found a dead bird over on Wakanda Buttress, and we were just looking at it, not really eating it, not really."
"Was it a black bird, Dolus?"
By now Molly's eyes were tiny slits, and she hissed out the words.
"Yeah, a blackbird, a red-winged blackbird, sort of."
The flock began muttering and whispering. What was Molly driving at?
"Couldn't have been a raven, could it?"
she shrieked. The other birds opened their eyes wide. A raven? Dolus and Zygadina eating a raven? How horrible! Surely Molly couldn't be implying that Dolus would actually eat another raven? Dolus looked around the circle. His pleading expression told everyone what he was about to say.
I guess it might have been a raven once, part of one anyway. This was serious. The main raven took over the questioning.
And did Zygadina eat any of it?
He asked Dolus. Yes, Dolus said, looking down and scratching in the snow with one foot. The wind swirled through the flock, ruffling their feathers. Every bird felt a chill, both from the steady north breeze and from the scene they were witnessing.
And now, Dolus, the main raven said, striding over to him, I want to know something else. Look at me.
Dolus turned toward the main raven. The main raven looked at Dolus, and the two birds locked eyes.
Did you eat any of it, Dolus Cici?
For a long moment, the only sound was the whisper of snowflakes skipping around the feet of the raven's enders. Dolus stared at the main raven, and the main raven stared at him. Finally, Dolus broke loose from the main raven's gaze. He looked down again, and he spoke in a voice that could barely be heard.
No, I didn't eat any.
With that, Dolus spread his wings, leapt into the air, and flew away. So did Garth. The other bird started breathing again.
See, Molly said, it's just what I expected. Dolus has been hanging around with Zygadina, and you know what she does with any dead raven she finds.
Anger hardened her voice.
Zygadina's a menace. She knows what she's doing. I think she's tried to get Dolus and Garth hooked on the stuff.
Zack looked at Molly, considering. Then he spoke, saying what every other bird was thinking, but afraid to say out loud.
Molly, did you think that Dolus wanted to come along?
Here he stopped, searching for the words.
That he was hoping to find Sarah and Brendan and Marg
dead?
The flock shifted its attention to Molly. Her eyes flashed.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking, and the way Dolus looked just now confirmed it.
The other birds all began talking at once, either stating that they too had figured out what Dolus was up to, or that no, Dolus would never do anything like that. Or would he?
CCs, please, CCs, the main raven croaked. Order, order.
The other birds quieted.
Before we all jump to conclusions, let us be reminded that it is unnatural for a raven to ingest another raven. And we cannot assume that Dolus has engaged in this highly inappropriate, in fact prohibited, activity. The freedom to eat what we please is one of the three freedoms enjoyed by all ravens. But, and here the main raven looked very grave, cannibalism is not included in that freedom.
Scratch spoke up. Zygadina's always eaten dead ravens. I seen her myself. Real scary to watch, too. She just rips right in, guts and everything. Real disgusting and...
That will do, Scratch, the main raven interrupted.
Kathy had listened to the discussion with her bill hanging open, horror struck, and now she was wobbling on her feet. Molly threw a wing over her.
Now then, Kathy, he went on, you have nothing to fear from Zygadina. She never comes over to this side of the valley. Zack and I make sure of that, don't we, Zack?
Absolutely right. She hasn't tried that in a long time.
Zack was croaking loudly, his wings set back, his head thrust forward, and his neck feathers ruffled out. The main raven did the same. Just then, a small gray bird fluttered out of the wind and landed atop the biggest spruce at Raven's End. With its longish tail and its lovely white eye rings, it could only be...
Maya!
Croaked all the ravens together.
"Hello, everyone," Maya said. "Sorry to be late, but several stories just came in, and the wind kind of slowed me down getting here."
"Oh, Maya, I'm so glad to see you," Molly called. "We thought you'd been lost in the storm."
"Well, you may not be so glad when you've heard the news. Here goes." And she began her routine, starting with several single, wistful notes. And then, as if rolling off a printing press, page after page, came her report.
"At the top of the news this morning, the weather. An Arctic frontal storm hit the area late yesterday afternoon. Winds reached gale force, bringing blowing snow and reduced visibility. The overnight low froze the beaver ponds completely across, and the voles report enough new snow to begin preparing their winter runs underneath. The winter solstice is still many days away, but everyone expects this snowfall to last, even on south-facing slopes."
Maya stopped for a breath.
Molly heard the sound of raven wings behind her, and noticed that Greta had arrived. Why couldn't she ever get here on time? Molly thought of coming right out and scolding her a little, but then Maya started up again.
"Optimistic Molt, the weasel, saw a member of the Raven's End flock killed yesterday."
At this, the other birds gasped.
"She reports having a conversation with Colin C.C. some weeks before. Yesterday she watched him approach a pair of humans who were hunting along the summit trail."
Oh, Colin, thought Molly. She had told him over and over, never get near humans. And now he's dead. Zack was right about hearing the sounds of humans shooting. Shooting Colin. Her wings began to flutter in grief.
According to Molt, Colin C.C. actually grabbed an item of food away from one of the humans, at which point the other one shot him in the wing. He tried to run up the slope when he was hit again. He was last seen falling over the south face.
Molly couldn't help herself. She croaked a long, slow cry of sorrow. "Craw!" Maya had to stop until the main raven asked for calm. The bad news wasn't over.
"This tragedy is compounded by the disappearance in the storm of three other Yamnuska ravens, Marg, Brendan, and Sarah C.C., all of the Raven's End flock. Early reports indicate that the trio were overtaken by the cold front while on the south side of the Bow Valley, well downwind of Yamnuska, and they haven't been seen since."
Molly was beside herself. She called out in grief again,
"Craw!"
And this time Scratch and Wheedle joined in, croaking so miserably that even the main raven couldn't contain himself. He hadn't ever been known to cry, but now he gave forth a long, deep, velvety groan that perfectly expressed the misery sweeping over what remained of the flock. Maya stopped and looked down at the birds. She was surprised at how badly they were taking all this. Having passed along so much bad news over the years, she was personally immune to it. Perched impassively, she simply waited for the crawing and groaning to stop. Eventually it did. The ravens were growing numb with the shock of losing four flock members overnight.
"Moving to other news," she started again.
But Greta interrupted her. Greta's voice was not loud, but whenever she spoke, everyone stopped to listen. She had not been crying.
"Most of the time, Maya's pretty good," she said. "Pretty factual. But this time I'll have to correct her."
Maya was stunned. No one had ever questioned the accuracy of her reporting. Her bill dropped open, and a single note fell out.
"Warn?"
A wistful question mark. Greta continued,
"I suggest, friends, that you take a look to the south and tell me what you see."
The other birds swung their heads toward the Bow Valley. Through the icy haze hanging over the Rockies, they could just barely make out four ravens flying toward them. One was flying very awkwardly, favoring its right wing, and another seemed to be limping through the air, too. All flew weakly against the oncoming northerly breeze, but they were gradually getting closer. "Oh, Zack, could it be?" Molly cried, trying hard not to believe her eyes.
"By the trees, Molly, I can see Marg,"
Zack called excitedly. "And there's Brendan and Sarah, and by golly, Colin is with them."
The flock was instantly in an uproar. All the birds were hopping about, flapping their wings, dancing with delight. Some of them leapt into the air and flew off to escort the four lost ravens, now so close that everyone could hear them croaking their own happiness at making it home. The entourage landed at Raven's End in a great flurry of wings. Amid the ensuing hubbub, each flock member welcomed back the Raven's Enders, who had been given up for dead.
"Oh, Sarah," said Molly, touching the young raven's bill tenderly with her own. "Oh, Marg," said Kathy, doing the same to her adult friend.
"Colin, you big lunk," said Zack. "I'm so glad to see you. Well, tell me what happened."
After a time, when the essentials of the story had been related, the main raven brought the meeting back to order.
My friends, let us end this morning's flap with the most joyous motion we have ever shared."
"Hear, hear," called several birds.
The flock formed a circle once again, wingtip to overlapping wingtip, and each bird filled its lungs with crisp mountain air. Then, all together, they raised their wings and let forth a mighty roar of raven strength and common power. "Rock-a-taw!" Never had the Raven's End flock meant it more. The sound shook snow loose from the trees surrounding the circle. The sound rode south on the breeze, across the wooded slopes below and out over the Bow Valley. Every wild thing within earshot, and a long earshot it was, stopped for a moment, hearing and considering what it heard. The sound of the ravens of Yamnuska telling the world at large that all was well again. All wasn't completely well for Colin. He couldn't raise his right wing much, and the pain of trying had resulted in him saying "Ock" instead of "Rock-a-taw." But the thunderous outburst from the rest of the flock made him feel wonderful anyway. Maya looked down from her perch, taking notes on the whole event. This was definitely going to require a special edition.
Chapter 15. When the rest of the flock had gone, Greta looked at Colin's hurts with a clinical eye. She prodded him here and there with her bill, saying, "Breathe in," and "Breathe out," and "Raise that wing higher. I know it hurts. Higher." At length, her examination was complete. "Well, you've been winged, as the humans are so fond of saying," she stated. "Nasty wound in the right flight muscle. I can't see how you got home on that. Bullet went right through. Missed the bone somehow. Got a bruise on your tail, but no bleeding there. 3 primaries gone, 2 tail feathers, and half a dozen secondaries, and you're stuck with a fair number of bent shafts and dinged up tips until the spring molt." Colin looked down. "It was all my own fault," he said miserably. "I'll never trust humans again." "Indeed," Greta replied. "So take it easy for a few days and let that wound heal." Then she muttered something under her breath. Colin heard it anyway. "They always learn hard." "What?" he said. "Who learns hard?" "Oh, all you ravens who think you know everything, but don't." "Greta," Colin said, ignoring her insult, "I had a strange experience during that storm." "Ah, let me guess. Did the wind speak to you?" "Yes. How did you know?"
Oh, it's happened to me, too. What did it say to you?
It was terribly angry with me.
Eh, typical cold front, Greta declared. They're always like that. Can't reason with them at all. Colin continued. But we made a deal, Greta. We actually made a deal. We decided not to fight each other. I made a deal with the wind.
Yes, and that's nice. But don't get carried away with yourself. In point of fact, you barely survived that whole episode.
Colin looked away, embarrassed. But he quickly turned back.
Oh, well, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. I had a dream last night, in the crack in the cliff. I dreamed where Sarah was. I knew exactly where to find her, and it was because of that dream.
Greta looked hard at Colin. She came close and peered right into each of his eyes. Then she croaked softly and hopped back.
Colin, she said quietly, there's a word for all this dream stuff. It's called second sight. And I can see it in your eyes. It's both a blessing and a curse.
She looked away for a moment, as if recalling something. Then she continued in the same soft, knowing voice.
But there's nothing you can do about it. You'll have to get used to it, that's all. Act on it when the need arises, like with Sarah. You'll know when. And remember this. Don't talk to the other birds about it. They'll think you're crazy. If you must talk about it with someone, talk about it with me. Just me. No one else. Okay?
Her voice had become as serious as he had ever heard it. But it was friendly, too, and confiding. Okay, said Colin. He looked over to Greta, now clumsily preening her back feathers. First she had understood about his dreams, and now she had offered him a kind of companionship that no other flock member could. Henceforth he would treat her differently. He knew, as surely as he had known where to find Sarah, that he could trust Greta completely.
Thanks, Greta, he said, and he meant it. You're welcome.
She flew gently away, her old wings beating slowly. Chapter 16. It took several days for things to return to normal at Raven's End. Colin couldn't fly much, and neither could Marg, who seemed exhausted mentally as well as physically. Sarah was still nursing the worst headache of her life. After examining her, Greta had remarked that the only reason Sarah had any brains left was that she had so many to begin with. Brendan was the only one who had come through the experience undamaged. In fact, he was already looking back on it with pride. The whole thing, he decided, was a kind of test. And he had passed.
It was awesome.
Brendan was talking with Garth, who was about his own age.
I mean, there I was. The wind, the snow, everything. And like, I'm still here. I can handle anything now.
Garth looked at him out of the corner of his eye.
Oh, yeah? There may be a few things you can't handle, Brendan.
Huh? Like what?
Oh, like, well, like a whole other side of life you don't know anything about.
Brendan glanced back at Garth.
So you're going to tell me you've been nesting somebody, right?
Garth looked down. He scratched in the snow with one foot.
But no way, Brendan. Nesting time is a long way off. You know that.
So what's this other side of life?
Well, I can't tell you anything more. Dolus and me, we... Dolus, you hang around with that bird like he owns you.
No way. I can quit any time I like.
Brendan's head jerked up. Quit what? He asked.
Oh, nothing. Forget I said that. And Garth flew off.
Brendan was wondering what kind of trouble this implied when Sarah settled down beside him.
Hi, she said.
She looked at Brendan. Then she looked away. She started preening herself, running her bill along the edges of her folded wings. Brendan hadn't seen much of Sarah the last few days. She had been staying with Marg since the incident in the Bow Valley, and they roosted farther west along Yamnuska than Brendan did.
Oh, hi, Brendan replied. How's your head?
Lots better, way better. Well, the sun still hurts my eyes, though.
That must have been so scary, Brendan said soberly. What did you think about lying there on the ground?
Couldn't think about much, she replied. My thinker was all messed up, sort of. I passed out.
Did you, like, have a dream?
Oh, yes, I dreamed I was back at Yamnuska, all safe and everything. But really, I guess, I kind of knew I was going to die.
Wow, you really thought you were really going to die?
Uh-huh, for sure.
And what did you think when I came for you?
Oh, Brendan, that was wonderful. Like, I was buried in the snow, okay? And I woke up under all this white stuff. It was really weird. So then I try to move, and I can't, because the snow is too deep. And I'm trying to keep it together, because I'm getting really scared, and I don't know where I am. And then there's this big bill shoving me in the back, and then there's another one, and I see it's ravens, and I'm thinking, this is so cool. I'm buried in the snow, but somebody's digging me out. And then...
Here she stopped. She looked at Brendan, whose glossy brown eyes were staring intently into her own.
And it was you, Brendan. You and Colin and Marg, and mostly you, I guess. It was you.
Brendan raised his head and unfurled his wings. He fluffed the feathers out under his chin. Tilting back and forth, he croaked happily several times.
And Brendan, Sarah said, still gazing at him.
What, Sarah?
Brendan looked into her eyes. He saw his own reflection there, and she must have been seeing her reflection in his eyes. The two of them together, just the two of them, here at Raven's End, looking so deeply into each other's eyes, beginning to glimpse all their secrets and their passions, getting ready to tell them to each other.
Go on, Sarah. You can tell me anything. Anything you want.
Brendan, the part I don't get was that the snow kept me warm all night. I mean, how could it do that? Snow is cold, okay? And so how could snow keep a bird warm?
Brendan's neck feathers snapped back down under his chin. His bill clicked shut. His wings returned to their usual parking place atop his back, and he looked down to the snow. It was full of raven tracks, his and hers. Two tangled patches where their feet had been going up and down excitedly as they talked.
Well, she asked, do you know anything about that? I guess I could ask Greta. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it?
Brendan managed to smile.